Welcome to Kingston Reid's Word to the Wise podcast series for HR and safety professionals.
Welcome back to our safety and regulatory podcast for October 2025. My name is Michael Stutley, a partner in the Kingston Reid Perth office, and I'm joined by two of the country's preeminent safety and regulatory practitioners as we look at some key issues brought to the fore during National Safe Work Month. John Macris, our National Head of Safety and Regulatory, and Liam Fraser, a partner in our Queensland office. It's great to have you both here.
Thanks for having us, Michael. It's an interesting time of the season at the moment. We've got Safety Month. It's been a big month across Australia with lots of initiatives and programs and certainly some legislative changes across Victoria, New South Wales and other jurisdictions.
Yeah, great to be with both you and yourself, Michael.
Now, guys, by the time we go to air, the 2025 National Safe Work Month will be coming to a close. So we thought it would be timely to dig into what's been going on in the work health safety world, particularly the rising regulator focus on psychosocial hazards and what this means for practitioners, GMs, HR and lawyers alike. Now, John, Liam, we've previously presented a show on psychosocial hazards and risks, but today we're going to build on that foundation and turning up the spotlight because the regulators appear to be turning it up too. John, let's start with you. We've run a podcast before on psychosocial hazards, but over the past year or so, I sense the regulator and the enforcement environment for psychosocial risks has really elevated. Can you give us your overview? What's changed? What's driving it? Why should non-work health safety specialists pay attention now?
Sure. Thanks, Michael. Yeah, look, I think you're absolutely right. We're at the point where psychosocial risks are no longer a nice to have in any conversation. They're really mainstream now and certainly mainstream in enforcement and regulation by the regulators across all jurisdictions. And what's changed? What's new? A couple of things. The first one, the regulators, for example, in New South Wales, have explicitly flagged psychosocial hazards and risks, those particularly relating to workload, job change, insecurity of jobs, restructuring, poor or lack of consultation, as is within their remit under the health and safety laws. We're seeing actions taken historically that, you know, would have been HR or IR matters rather than safety matters. And a really good example of that is the recent New South Wales regulators intervening in two university restructures on the basis of allegations of psychosocial harm. And in those cases, you know, really wanting the organisations to slow down their decision-making and consult further with their workforce around psychosocial implications of the restructure. Secondly, I think the cultural understanding is catching up. Workers, unions, governments are increasingly aware of psychosocial risks and the fact that they can be serious risks. And organisations are being challenged when they treat change processes or job security issues in a purely IR, industrial relations or opt-in type sense, rather than as a proactive safety duty where they're thinking about the risks up front. I think thirdly, for non-work health and safety specialists, HR practitioners, you know, general managers, lawyers, the message is that obligations now require you to think of psychological or psychosocial safety in the same way you think of other physical risks like slips, trips, falls, machinery hazards. It's just not optional. And so in short, regulators have the power and they expect organisations to be proactive and, you know, organisations need to pay attention to make sure they're proactively thinking about the risks and how HR functions, IR functions, workers' comp functions are all interacting with work health and safety. So it's an interesting environment out there.
Thanks, John. It sure is. Now, there's a lot to unpack there and there's a few spoilers for what we're about to talk about today. But Liam, bringing you in on this because I know that we have had many discussions at length on some of the things that John has just mentioned. From the practical side for HR practitioners, GMs, PCBU, duty holders, this means you can no longer treat the psychosocial matters as optional or just part of a culture discussion, as John just mentioned. What are you seeing in practice when clients ask, what do I need to do differently now?
Yeah, thanks, Michael. On the what do I need to do differently front, I think I'd say that there's three practical shifts I'm seeing major organisations or larger organisations having to make or acknowledging that they need to make, and they're probably acknowledging that quite urgently now. The first one I think we're seeing is that risk assessment in the integration piece. So rather than saying, oh, we'll just deal with the mental health part later, or we'll rely on our EAP, or we've got mental health first aid training. You now see organisations embedding psychosocial hazard identification into their WHS risk management processes. And that means asking basics like, what hazards are created by this change? Is that a restructure? Is that a job role change? Is that workload changes? Is it a reporting line shift? All of those sorts of changes creating or manifesting in hazards. And what controls will we apply and how will we monitor? Are we building it in consultation and worker input early, or are we leaving that to after the decisions have been made? And we've seen how that's played out in certain contexts. So the second one is also on documentation and governance. So clients are increasingly asking us, when we do a restructure or there's a major workplace change, what's the documented plan? What are we creating? What evidence are we generating? Have we identified the hazard appropriately? Have we communicated with workers? Have we offered support? How are we monitoring the stressors or the indicators of psychosocial harm? Again, is that being communicated? All of those kinds of aspects, because in the event of a regulatory or legal scrutiny, you want to be able to show that you didn't just treat this as a culture or a HR side piece. And then the third aspect that we're looking at is the leadership or line manager competence. A risk that I've seen repeatedly is that organisations focus on the big change, whether that be the big restructure or the big reorganisation, but then they forget how the real exposure is the change, how that change is implemented on a day-to-day basis by managers. So simple things like managers calling meetings with short notice, there can be information leaks, performance expectations shift, job descriptions change, workloads rise without support. These are all classic psychosocial hazards that are associated with job insecurity, role ambiguity, high demand, low support. So in practice, yes, what you always do or have always done for physical hazards with that assess, control, monitor, but applying that lens deliberately to the psychosocial side of workloads, changes in job design, job security, role clarity, it's just not optional anymore.
Yeah, thanks, Liam. I think you've made some really important points there. And one of them that sounds true is that what we're really telling clients now is to check their front lines. Essentially, are managers trained? Are their communication plans sound? Do they have supports in place? For example, the EAP, counselling, peer support, etc. Are they ready and are they monitoring so you catch distress, for lack of a better term, early?
Yeah, it's the real kind of aspect of controlling these psychosocial hazards early is in the same way that you would for physical hazards. You teach people how to identify them, how to assess them, control them and monitor them. But like I say, applying that lens deliberately to the psychological side is an important aspect, and giving your line managers the right information and training on how to do that is important, because that's, I think, one of the aspects of difficulty in controlling psychosocial harm is just not being able to identify the hazards or assess the risks appropriately because your line managers aren't trained enough.
Yeah, good. Well, let's tie this in with a concrete example. And I guess here is where one of our topical items comes in that John helpfully spoiled earlier. You recall the story of a university where Safe Work New South Wales issued a prohibition notice, effectively halting a planned redundancy or restructure on the basis that the workers are and will be exposed to a serious and imminent risk of psychosocial harm. John, this really is quite something. A regulator stepping in, halting job cuts because of psychosocial risk. What's your read on this in terms of the significance and what it signals for organisations around the country?
Yeah, Michael, it's a strong signal. At first, it's telling us that the regulators are willing to use, you know, their arsenal, which includes powerful tools like prohibition notices in the psychosocial space and not just in the physical safety space. ACT WorkSafe recently came out and said, you know, we're focusing on the big ticket items and the serious risks in psychosocial. I just was in a webinar this morning for WorkSafe Victoria, who have recently released their code of practice on psychosocial, and their regs will commence in early December. And they were, you know, hinting towards the same thing. You know, we're going to use our arsenal because these issues are causing grief in workplaces and in the workers' comp scheme. So, you know, they're certainly going to be using their tools where historically notices were used for things like machinery hazards or high-risk construction work. Here we're seeing them applied, you know, particularly in New South Wales, in white-collar context in university restructures. Second, I think it means for major organisations, and I'd include in that universities, public service bodies, agencies, consultancies, any PCBU with significant workforce change, that you can't assume your restructure is purely an IR finance, you know, efficiency exercise divorced from work health and safety. The regulator is saying really clearly, particularly in New South Wales, but I'm sure elsewhere, we'll intervene if the change process presents a serious risk to harm. And we want you to consult with your workforce. And that was kind of the issues that arose in New South Wales. It also emphasises what's an imminent harm, and the wording used by the regulator is a serious and imminent risk of psychological harm, and that's what the regulator said in their notices. And this sets a pretty high bar, because one that organisations, you know, really need to be aware of, and it signals that better processes, better and more consultation, better documentation aren't optional. They're now, you know, part of the required landscape. And, you know, the regulators are asking for those, and they're also issuing notices for that information. I think fourth, from a legal risk and compliance perspective, it really broadens the horizon. It's not just about workplace injuries from, you know, the slips, trips and falls that we're all used to anymore. It's about the way you engage the workforce in change, how you manage job security issues, how you communicate. I think you mentioned, Michael, training for frontline managers is going to be a significant issue about how they deal with these things and how they engage with them, how you manage job security, how you support workers, and how you monitor any aftermath. And if you get that wrong, you know, the regulators will be looking closely, and there's a risk of exposure to regulatory risk, legal risk, and reputational risks. So in short, you know, as you said, we've moved now. You know, it's really a wake-up call that psychosocial risks are frontline issues and frontline enforcement issues.
Now, Liam, from your experience, what are the red flags in a restructure or significant change process that a PCBU should be looking for? The things that might trip a psychosocial hazard risk and possibly attract regulator attention?
Yeah, from what I'm seeing, Michael, there's red flags, I guess, in several different categories. Some of them are pretty obvious and others are a little bit more subtle. So just sort of working through what we know about how restructures normally run: short notice, poor communication. So for example, employees receiving a meeting invitation with very little notice, or being told that the outcome is already determined. This creates real uncertainty around, I guess, the nature of the communication. Their role ambiguity increases anxiety. It's all classic psychosocial hazard stuff. Another category is a lack of meaningful consultation. So if you treat consultation as a box-ticking exercise rather than a genuine dialogue, it's going to increase the risk. I always like to talk about consultation processes and draw the distinction between consulting with your workforce and consulting at them. And sometimes people tend to fall into the latter category of consulting at their workers about decisions rather than that genuine dialogue. And then job insecurity and role ambiguity, they're classic psychosocial hazards as well. When people don't know where they stand, or it looks like the decisions are finalised before consultation or before the consultation has been meaningful, that creates this high demand, low control and low support situation. Psychosocial hazard is obvious there. So sudden changes in workload or redistribution without support, for example, when you're in a restructure and you assume other people will pick up extra tasks without actually planning for that, you're creating those sorts of excessive demands. Monitoring the gaps post-change is also another important side of it. So often organisations focus on the change, but then don't monitor what happens after the change has been implemented. So if we're looking through this in a safety context, are staff exhibiting the signs of distress? Is absenteeism climbing? Are the performance issues increasing and complaints rising? If you're not monitoring those, then you'll miss the risk event. If all you're looking at is, great, we've managed to offload a certain amount of overhead from the finance perspective, then you're going to miss compliance with your work health and safety duties. And another aspect is the lack of documentation and alignment between what your safety obligations are and any IR or HR processes. So when the change is treated purely as a an IR exercise and you're not documenting this through WHS processes, you're not identifying the appropriate risks and assessing them, and they're not communicated through safety committees, there's not going to be reports back to the boards, you're all increasing your exposure because there's just going to be no documentation to rely upon if the regulator comes knocking. From a practical standpoint, when advising clients, we like to say, before you launch into the change, have that psychosocial risk assessment, just like you would do if you got a new piece of machinery, document it, build supports in, then monitor and ensure that your processes are actually keeping people safe, because the regulators are now looking for that kind of approach. They're not giving any leeway that we might have expected or might have seen in the past.
So I want to raise something which is a little bit sensitive, maybe a little bit controversial, and it really does stem from the jarring effect of the intervention, the regulator intervention in the university restructures. It is the elephant in the room, really, and it's something that we've long heard in this space. It's a term which I don't particularly like, but I think that for the purposes of this podcast, we should raise it and discuss it. And it's this idea that mental health is being weaponized in the workplace. In fact, I read an article a little while back in the AFR, which raised this very issue. And it was in the context of, at the time, another three or so more universities potentially being exposed to the same process that we've just talked about with the regulator. John, now that we have seen these developments in this space and 12 months has passed since we last discussed the idea of weaponization, have your views changed?
Look, it's a really important, as you say, a really sensitive question. And I think it's one that the profession and workplaces probably need to talk about more openly. When we first discussed this notion of weaponizing mental health, I was cautious about using that kind of language because it can imply that employees and unions are somehow misusing mental health concerns for strategic or other industrial advantages. And that can risk undermining genuine psychosocial safety efforts. And, you know, in the past, we've also seen the language, not just in psychosocial, but generally the weaponizing of safety for other purposes. For example, you know, raising psychosocial safety complaints as a way of halting organizational change or framing all workplace conflict or change as a mental health hazard. But I think we need to separate the narrative from the law. The regulator's job isn't to take sides in industrial dispute, although I know some employers will say it feels like that. It's to ensure that risks to health and safety, including psychosocial health, are managed so far as is reasonably practicable.
And I think that's the really important takeaway here, isn't it? That the idea of weaponization is really a bit of a red herring, that actually, as you say, John, separating the narrative from the law is actually quite important. So if we were to look at that in particular, if an employer can demonstrate that it has properly identified psychosocial hazards, it has conducted consultation, it has applied appropriate controls and monitored for any signs or alarms of psychosocial harm, then the risk of weaponization largely evaporates because the organization has done what the law requires.
Yeah, that's right. I'd also say that in the psychosocial space, because the hazards are, you know, less visible than sometimes suspicion around when people raise issues like them, the truth is both can be real and both can be misused if the systems are poor. And I think what you're saying is right. You've got to have a process for thinking about them proactively and then managing those. And that's a, you know, systematic and structured way of dealing with them.
Okay, let's pivot to some other developments just to make sure the audience is across the broader landscape beyond psychosocial matters. One of these is a very interesting and important decision in SafeWork New South Wales and Tatham Express, where the court held that Tatham did not owe a primary duty under Section 19(1) of the Work Health Safety Act to a delivery truck driver who was engaged by another contractor, and that was because he was not working for Tatham's business or its undertaking. Liam, what should duty holders and their advisors take away from that decision about scope of duty, contractor versus subcontractor arrangements, and outsourcing risk?
Yeah, thanks, Michael. This is a really important decision, and I think quite helpful in clarifying boundaries of the primary duty. So a couple of the key takeaways I think that it's important to emphasise is, first, just because a worker is on your site or is doing work which assists your business or undertaking doesn't automatically mean that they are your worker under Section 19 of the Act. So boards, GMs, lawyers, they need to carefully assess who is doing what and under what contractual arrangements and who has control or influence over what work that worker is doing and who they're doing it for. Second, factors around control, direction, supervision, integration of work, etc., they all remain relevant. Businesses need to ask, does the worker form part of our business or undertaking, or are they working for another contractor who is performing that role independently? And if it's the latter, then your primary duty may not extend, though it may you may still have other duties to them, i.e. duty of to them as another person, or you're going to have due diligence obligations to ensure that what you're doing doesn't extend harm to them. Thirdly, for PCBUs who outsource work, that does not mean you have no duty. You need clarity on the boundaries, and you need to ensure that whoever does have a duty is appropriately managing those risks. You also need to remain vigilant around the circumstances, or if the circumstances change, if an arrangement changes so that you exercise more control, for instance, you may be picking up a direct duty. So there, that's probably a really key one as well. And then from a practical perspective, organisations should still be documenting their outsourcing arrangements and ensuring their contractual terms actually reflect the health and safety duties, ensuring that contractors have appropriate risk management systems, communicating who's responsible for what, checking compliance, and then monitoring to the extent that it is relevant for your business. Because if things do go wrong, the question of who had what duty will be heavily scrutinised.
John, we're fast running out of time. Any other recent work health safety law or regulatory activity that practitioners should have on their radar as we wrap up Safe Work Month for 2025?
Sure. I can certainly speak to a number of developments in New South Wales. We've got, you know, the regulator became a standalone regulator on 1 July, so they're pretty active. And, you know, we're seeing, not just in New South Wales, actually, but in all the jurisdictions, you know, the expansion of the inspectors in psychosocial units. So we're seeing psychosocial focused inspectors, certainly seeing those numbers increase. Safe Work Australia's got a model law review underway. And in the heavy vehicle space, there are amendments in the Queensland Parliament at the moment. If you've got heavy vehicles, you need to be mindful of those. We're hearing they're probably 12 months away, but they're very significant changes. And, you know, we've been sitting on some workers' comp changes, particularly around managing mental health claims, actually, and they haven't gone anywhere. But certainly we're waiting to see what, because they'll limit things like secondary psychological claims and those kinds of things. So there's quite a bit of activity out there, and certainly urging people to stay tuned to our updates and podcasts, because we'll certainly cover the key developments for our listeners.
That's great. Well, John, Liam, I think that's a wrap for today. Thanks to everyone for joining and listening into the podcast. I'm sure there's going to be plenty more to come. We've only just touched the surface today.
Yes. And as I mentioned, stay tuned, everyone, for the developments. We'll bring them to you as they arise.
Thanks all. Looking forward to it.